Folks, welcome to Pod X Medicine, the official podcast of the Academy of Extreme Environment Medicine. I am Sunny, and I've got the wonderful Evie with me again today. Evie, where are you? It looks like you're in prison.
Hey, Sunny. Well, it's some sort of prison, but it's quite delightful.
It
Still
looks
up in Sydney, living my best life.
living your best life. Officer training.
Yeah, indeed.
Doctoring wasn't enough.
It's nice to have a change every now and then, you know?
I'm sitting in Queensland in a hoodie. You are sitting south of me in a t-shirt.
It's warm. It's real warm and rainy.
I do not believe it. Evie, we got a really exciting guest today. He's a paramedic and a snake handler, snake catcher, snake extraordinaire. I'm not going to do his introductions because I'm terrible at them, but I am going to welcome Matt slash Jessica slash Harold slash Kenny. Matt, how are you?
Very well, thanks, Sunny. Thank you, Evie, as well. Look, I'm also got my hoodie on over in Perth. It's raining at the moment, so the sunny spots of the world are not playing the game at the moment.
Now
But look, thanks.
it is 2026, but your name says Jessica.
We'll leave that, hey. Now, look,
Yeah,
thanks, guys, for having me on today. It's actually quite humbling. I was very honoured when you guys asked if I could jump on and be a guest. And yeah, thank you very much for the opportunity to be here.
well, something exciting just happened recently. You have finally braved the 100 credit points of fellowship, so congratulations on that award. That is a milestone.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, it was quite a fun process, really. Tallying up everything that you've kind of done over the years, and yeah, it felt quite like a milestone. So I was pretty proud of myself for that, and thank the Academy for the recognition.
Well, mate, it's all about you, as is this podcast, because most medicos, let's go paramedics, nurses, and doctors, Evie, you can tell me I'm wrong, but most of them, particularly in Australia, are quite fearful of legless lizards and snakes. But you have made a career from this. Mate, can you start at the beginning? What do you do?
So like you said, I'm a paramedic, probably first and foremost. So I am based in Western Australia, so with St. John Ambulance over here. And I've been a paramedic, well, been with St. John for about 9 years, and did the whole London stint, which lots of people do now, prior to starting my career over here. And look, absolutely love paramedicine, and all the wonderful stuff that goes with that. But I guess you could say really my first love when it comes to all this stuff was snakes. So ever since I was a kid, been fascinated by anything that dangerous that could kill you, and snakes were the top of that list. So the trips to the zoo with mum, the reptile house would be the first place that I'd want to visit, and then would drag her back there 3 or 4 times throughout the day, seeing if the snakes had moved and could see them in some other variation. And look, when I finished school, I probably would have loved to have gone straight into something like that. I guess short of maybe going to zoology, couldn't quite see that pathway. And then just had a chance encounter about a year and a half ago with someone who does exactly what I do now. He owns a company called Snake R&R here in Perth, and we essentially train and teach all sorts of people how to safely catch and relocate all of the venomous snakes that we have over here, and or the snakes of medical significance that we have over here in WA. And yeah, so when I'm not in an ambulance, I'm kind of holding on to Dugites and King Browns, and that's my happy place.
Snakes of medical significance is a term I have not heard before. Evie, have you heard of this?
I haven't, but I love it. I'm going to use that from now on.
Yeah, look, I mean, so I guess I'll give you a bit of background with it. So Australia is actually quite unique in that we are the only country in the world that actually has more venomous snakes than non-venomous snakes, which I think is really cool because we love to, pump up that look at us, we're so dangerous and all of that. But there is some nuance to that. So in Australia, we have 214 species of snake, and 144 of those are venomous, but they're not all what I just classified earlier, medically significant. So some of the snakes we would call mildly venomous in that they would give you a bite and you might get some localized effects, but not necessarily like the systemic effects where you have the hematoxins, the neurotoxins essentially wreaking havoc throughout the body.
Mildly
Difficult to
venomous.
know. But
What?
yeah, look, I mean, It's true. It is true.
There's
So
something wrong with Australia
that's right.
where we gauge risk on, well, it's going to hurt you, but not that bad.
That's right.
But the measure is, well, what's bad? Death.
I mean, sure, but not least, I mean, it's quite rare to die from a snake bite in Australia, but there are obviously some ongoing complications and concerns with some of these snakes, even if you survive. So not all snakes are classified as medically significant, but the ones that we do use on the course, absolutely, if they were to bite you, would ruin your day and be a trip to hospital.
Use on the course.
Yeah, so.
There's a lot of assumed knowledge here, Matt. You're going to have to break this
All
down
right,
for me and
my
Evie.
bad. Okay, so essentially, so the training that we do, essentially anyone can sign up to do the course. It's a 1 day course where we cover a lot of topics. So the first kind of thing we discuss is the psychology of fear. So obviously snakes, it's a significant fear for a lot of people. A lot of myths. The media have a lot to do with that. But interesting enough, there's actually only two fears that we're born with: the fear of falling. That's why they do that, the whole Morrow test, the reflex when you're born, see that all the neural pathways are intact, and the fear of loud noises. And they think that every other fear is a learned behavior, and snakes very much fall into that category. And the ABC actually did a really cool, I wouldn't call it experiment, but observational study, I guess, recently, where they had a lot of babies on the ground, pythons crawling all around, babies fascinated, trying to pick the pythons up, hold them, and the parents were just on this perimeter around, trying to jump in, going, "No, that's not right," but the kids were fine with it. And so that's how you can see how, if they start to see how the parents are reacting, they start to learn those kind of behaviors. So we have a really good discussion about the psychology of fear and kind of set the day up, for what people might expect. We get some pythons out, people hold the pythons, and then we introduce snakes in a fairly, what we would say, deliberate, I guess, method. So we get the death adder out first, people freak out, death
The
adder.
first snake you get out, its name starts with death.
It's a very as far as all of our snakes go, it's probably the worst named snake. It came by it was misheard. So people heard it as death adders are ambush predators, so they don't actively hunt their prey. They literally just bury themselves in the sand or the leaf litter and wait for the prey to come to them. So people would stamp around all around this snake and it wouldn't react. So people thought they were deaf. And it's also not an adder. All of our venomous snakes are elapids. That's a special type of snake. So it's a terrible name, but it's a pretty calm snake if you, as far as our venomous snakes go. I know it's a lot. When I talk about this stuff for people that aren't passionate and love snakes, I appreciate these reactions are very, yeah. But we build on that. And we work our way out to essentially the dugong, which is our equivalent of the Eastern Brown for you guys over on the East Coast. A bit more of a fiery character, a bit more responsive, I guess, puts on defensive displays, a few lunges at people, open mouth kind of displays, and we work people through that and how you can safely kind of still catch these snakes and then go about relocating them. And then obviously a big part of the day is first aid, where I really love to kind of sink my teeth into it and dispel a lot of myths and go into some real good depth, I think, really beyond just that initial first aid, what the hospital does and anti-venom and all that stuff, which I think people quite enjoy.
I think I really like the term you use, the snakes with medical significance, because even the term alone makes snakes sound a lot less, scary. And as you
Sure.
say, a
Yeah.
lot of people probably have lots of misunderstandings and mis like, different perceptions of snakes. And I myself, sort of growing up in the country, being a keen hiker, whatnot, I don't mind snakes. Probably would maybe wouldn't go to your level of loving them, but
That's fair
I'd
enough.
prefer a snake over a spider any day.
It's fascinating. So
But
many people, actually say that though. They are more scared of spiders than snakes. It's quite an interesting
just the
phenomenon,
legs.
actually. Yeah.
Less legs is better. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
What do you reckon people's like biggest misconceptions of snakes are?
I think there's a lot. I think one of them is that snakes are actively out to chase or bite you. And when we do the course, you will see a number of times, or all throughout the day, really, you'll get a snake out. And if it's in an open environment and there's like a bin lid on the floor or someone's backpack lying on the floor, the snakes will often shoot towards that little spot to hide. And you're actively trying to chase the snake down to relocate it back where you want it. It's only when you really close up that space, corner that snake, that they really will then engage in some of that, what we call defensive. We will never say a snake is aggressive. It's a defensive kind of posture. And then at the end of the day, people are walking away and go, oh, well, actually, that was quite interesting. The snake really didn't want anything to do with me. And I think that's a huge, huge part. And yeah, I mean, you mentioned, on growing up on properties and hikes and that, people would go past snakes all day, every day, and not even realize it. They really don't want to be seen.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I've only ever seen a snake like a couple of times, and then they always just they go their own way. They do their own thing. Like I've never felt threatened by a snake, but I know people who will not go hiking because of snakes, and I find that really sad.
It is. It really is. I think, and I mean, one of the things we talk about, obviously, in the first aid is that it's a historical average, but we only have about 2 to 3 deaths every year from Australia. And we love to, pump the whole, look, we've got the top 10 most venomous snakes and all this kind of stuff, which is, generally true. But because of our health system, our chain of survival in some sense, if we're going to use that in the snake bite world, we have very few deaths from these snakes. And yeah, so it's a bit sad to hear that it limits, I guess, people's recreational activities for that fear. So yeah.
I mean, you could call it an irrational fear. I mean, it's a very similar conversation that I've heard with the shark researchers and people saying, I won't go swimming in the ocean because of sharks. And I do get it. We don't want to be anyone's lunch. You don't want to be bitten by a snake. But I mean, part of the strategy of going for a hike or an explore or a swim or is understanding the issue and also understanding what to do if the issue takes place. So, if we use North America, for example, they've got bears and wolves and things. And so I would probably feel a little bit more vulnerable going for a hike in the woods there because I've never used a bear spray. I'd probably end up shooting myself in the face with it before I got the bear. But there'd be a lot of people who don't actually understand how to even intervene from a first aid perspective or even understand, you're saying Australia's got the, one of the best medical capabilities in the world for responses to snake bites. I would hope so if we have 214 snakes and 144 of them are venomous. I mean, does that mean, sorry, Evie, I'm going to use your language here, Dr. Evie. We've got 144 snakes of medical significance. Is that fair?
Oh,
No,
look.
see, the mildly venomous ones aren't of medical significance, Evie. This is.
Well, I hesitate because for some people, people can have still anaphylactic reactions, and for some people, I guess, and there's no way of knowing. Well, unless you know snakes, that's why we treat every snake as potentially falling into that category. There's no way of knowing for a start if you've actually been envenomated. So about 70 to 80% of the time, our brown snakes, so again, your eastern browns, your western browns, and whatnot, they'll give you a dry bite. So they'll bite you, but they don't actually envenomate. But there's no way of knowing that at the time of being bitten. And likewise, if you don't know what snake bit you, it really should be treated as a snake of medical significance until proven otherwise.
don't know what snake bit me. It was that one. But no, seriously, what do people
Definitely.
do then? Because I mean, there'd be a lot of people fearful of this because they actually don't know what to do, and the treatments have changed several times over the years in terms of how you intervene. What's evidence-based best practice at the moment for snake bites within Australia?
Yeah, so it's still the pressure immobilization technique or the PIT technique, which is still taught in all the first aid courses and what should be at the very least. So the reason that works is because our snakes have tiny fangs. They're only about 2 to 3 mil in length. So when they bite, you often a lot of people don't even know they've been bitten, which is quite scary for some people to hear. It's often like a little scratch on the skin, but all it needs to do is just break under the tissue, under the skin, sorry, into the subcutaneous tissue, and goes into the lymphatic system. So the idea being that when we use the pressure immobilization technique with a snake bite bandage, we're compressing that lymph and slowing that flow of venom before it becomes a systemic issue. And look, that is a tried and tested technique. One of the stats, I guess, or the lines they like to kind of thrash out is that there's been no recorded death in Australia with a properly fitted pressure and mobilisation bandage. The key word being properly fitted. So sometimes the bandages are on too loose, too tight, they've been too delayed. But when a bandage is put on almost immediately at the right pressure, it essentially saves lives. So, and one of the underrated components of that is the immobilization. So you obviously will immobilize the limb with a splint of some description, but it's full body immobilization as well. So not getting the patient to walk, bringing the stretcher, whatever the help is to the patient is underrated but crucial in venation.
Yeah, I've seen it once actually, in hospital, obviously. I think I can't remember if it was the paramedics or like, family members that treated this one patient, but she had a obviously very well put on pressure mobilization bandage, came in, no symptoms, feeling well. It had been like, an hour, maybe a bit more since the bite. We were all like, nah, it's gonna be a dry bite, like all of the other hundreds that come into rural EDs. But like as soon as the bandage came off, she arrested basically. So that was obviously a good example. But I suppose sort of building on like that from what the public can do. And I don't actually know if this is the case in paramedic services in Australia. I'm pretty sure New South Wales doesn't have like New South Wales Ambulance doesn't have any anti-venom or anything like that. I don't know if it's different over in WA just because of the remoteness. But is that something that you would see as being useful for paramedics or, very remote places to hold on to?
For paramedics,
No?
definitely not. So there's a lot of misconception when it comes to anti-venom. So every year in Australia, we have about 3,000 bites, but only about 200, maybe 250 patients every year will go on to need anti-venom. So for those that don't know, anti-venom is produced via horses in Australia. So they inject horses with very small amounts of venom, increasing the amount over time, and then the horse mounts an immune response. They drain about 10 liters of blood from the horse, put it through a centrifuge, separate it with the plasma, and then they isolate the antibodies. The problem is that about 3 to 5% of the population has an anaphylactic reaction when given antivenom because people are anaphylactic to horses. So antivenom always needs to be given in a resuscitation cubicle at hospital, fully prepared for an anaphylactic reaction. It's a really tricky situation because you then go down your anaphylaxis protocol, adrenaline, whatnot. But then ultimately, that antivenom needs to start again because they need the antivenom and on high alert that they might have a further reaction. It also needs a cold chain storage. So it's very, very tightly controlled in a fridge. Obviously, that's problematic in the pre-hospital world and the environment we work in. So from a paramedic point of view, I don't think it really has a place at the moment. RFDS, so in WA, RFDS do carry antivenom and they can deliver that if needed. But even with the tyranny of distance in some of these, larger states, Queensland, Western Australia, a lot of these kind of hospitals now have are stocked with antivenom, knowing what snakes are in those regions. And so, what's really interesting though about antivenom, and there has been some change in the last year or two about how the hospitals approach this, is that in trauma, we talk about a golden hour. So, that first hour, let's get all those key interventions done. They found the equivalent for antivenom and it's 3 hours. And what they have found recently is that there are patients who've been receiving antivenom at hospital, but the hospital is getting really trying to be too cute, nuanced, working out exactly what snake bit the patient. And that window of effective kind of antivenom was blowing out because I was too focused on exactly what snake bit the patient. So, the general approach now is that they will just look at what region you're in, and for somewhere like on the East Coast, they've kind of really simplified the process. So 90% of your bites are from an Eastern Brown, a tiger, or a Red Belly Black, and the Red Belly Black actually gets tiger snake antivenom. So what they'll do now is give you one vial of brown snake, one vial of tiger snake, and that will cover 90% of your bites. And so people are getting the antivenom in quicker. and it's more likely to get in within that 3 hour period to actually neutralize the venom. So they're trying to simplify the whole process, really.
And is there like
Noting
another
that you
one?
said though that golden hour is, or well, golden 3 hours in remote settings, or say, in the setting of expedition medicine, anything like that, or even just remote WA, how often would people actually get to antivenom within 3 hours?
Look, I think probably more than you think. I mean, a lot of these, we have like our regional hospitals still will have antivenom. So I work in Albany, which is, for those that don't know, about a 4.5 hour drive south of Perth. We have lots of tiger snakes, lots of dugongs, but our hospital antivenom for both. So we have, RFDS capability, but we're still 5 hours from Perth where our major hospitals are, but we are stocked with antivenom as well. And that's true for lots of hospitals, around the state as well. Like I said, though, there is a high percentage. So our brown snakes are the snakes that we are most likely to encounter, and they're the ones that also contribute to the most dry bites. So those patients don't need antivenom as well. So there's a bit of a, I guess, a silver lining, I guess, in that sense that, the snake you might encounter might be the one that also will give you a dry bite.
This whole wet bite, dry bite thing challenges me because I just feel like you're downplaying the significance of a dry bite. Now, hear me out. In 2002, Evie, you'll love this because in 2002, I was in the army and I was actually in Southeast Asia and I was sleeping on the ground because that's what we do. And I felt a snake go over my right arm. My hands were behind my head, sleeping in my hands, and I felt it slither over my arm. And so I did what we're taught to do in school in Australia. I froze, right? But then I sat there for so long with whatever this thing was not leaving that I started to query whether I had dreamt it, whether I was half asleep, or it could have been a caterpillar for all I know. But if this thing had slithered over my arm, it was currently happily resting next to my face. And so I needed to make a decision to sit there for the rest of the night silently, enduring probably nothing because I imagined it, or sit up in the dark and see. And I made the decision to sit up in the dark and see. And within, 0.8 seconds, I regretted that decision because I felt the whack on my left bicep. And I mean, it's comical now, it wasn't at the time, but I grabbed this thing and it was meaty and it was fleshy in the nighttime, and I flung it to the right just in a moment of panic-induced self-preservation. It landed on the poor guy sleeping next to me, so he woke with this hell-born creature descending on him from the heavens. And all I could see at that point under a very small light was two prong marks bleeding from my right arm, and I just thought, well, that sucks, that's the end of me. They had one of the local army medics, so not from Australia, one of the local army medics respond to me, and he basically laughed at me. He said the snakes are not the same as Australia. He suspected this was a cobra based on what I described and the size of the fangs. And he said, I won't die regardless, but I may get sick. It's either a dry bite or a wet bite, but given I've got one bite, it was probably a dry bite, and so I'm okay to go back to sleep. I felt pretty
This
vulnerable.
kills me, Sonny, hearing all of this, mate.
This.
There's so many levels to that I've wanted to jump in, but I'll let you.
This is 2002, so I mean 23 years ago. Anyway, I started to get quite sick. I should point out, our guys did put a PIB on me. That was at least supplied. But I did get quite sick that night. My vision was quite blurry. I felt nauseous. I felt dizzy. All my joints were hurting. I felt like hell. And all I kept getting told was, I'll be fine because it's a dry bite. And I felt like punching the person who said that next, except I could barely get up. And so my experience of a dry bite was my opinion of hell. I didn't die.
See, so there's a few things that's mentioned there. So for a start, it was slightly incorrect in saying that. So our snakes, like I said, they're part of the elapids family. That's the same family that cobras and your black mambas and crates are example. They're all part of the same family, those small fixed front fangs. So their delivery system of venom is the same, and that's why that pressure mobilization bandage, which I'm glad they did put on,
Probably
theoretically should.
way too tight. We weren't trained that well.
Yeah, it would, but it would still, if, even if it's on too tight, it still would compress that lymphatic system. But we try not to get it too tight. So that's the first thing. So yes, there are snakes over in Asia or in Africa that are part of that same family that our snakes are involved in. The fact that you had symptoms though would suggest that it wasn't a dry bite. Now, unless they were self-induced, I'm freaking out because I've been bitten by a snake and I'm tachycardic now and I'm making myself nauseous. Well, that's a different story.
All the above.
All the above, right? So yeah, the other thing, if you really, I mean, not, I don't want to scare people off snakes and stuff. And when you said where you were in the crate, which is a common snake in Asia, is known to crawl into people lying on the floor into their bedding, and they deliver often a painless bite, and they are highly highly venomous, and so people don't even know they've been bitten. So try and get yourself off the ground if you're in those environments.
I feel like there's some victim blaming here, Matt. I had nowhere else to
Okay, I'm sorry. I'm sorry about your lived experience there, Sonny. It sounded horrible, mate.
stay.
I'm glad that you're
But
still here today.
me too, and I'm grateful for that. Hey, really quickly then, the PIB. I mean, we throw around the term PIB, but there's so many opinions on how this would be put on properly. And this is what I think also confuses people, because there are those who swing the pendulum either way staunchly, and there are those who say the PIB should be put on the top of the limb and work down towards the bite and then back up, and there's those who say it should be put on over the bite and then move back up the limb and back down. There's about 26 different ways I've heard you can put a PIB on, and I'd be curious to know from someone who is across, both pre-hospital care and the snake industry, what is actually industry best practice at the moment?
Yeah, you're right. There's so many variations that are taught here. And so I have a little memory jog that hopefully can help people. And it's tip to pit wherever you've been bit, or tip to hip. So distal to proximal.
No, run with the poem. What's the poem?
Tip to pit wherever you've been bit.
Evie, come on. So good.
Now, yes, you're right. You will read some literature or some guidelines, and they say, wrap the bite site 3 times, then work your way down, work your way up. In terms of the studies that have gone into the pit, so the pit is recommended for snake bite, for a funnel web spider, for cone snail, and for the blue-ringed octopus. The cone snail and the blue-ringed octopus, the evidence for that is actually very thin. It's more anecdotal, but in terms of any kind of solid evidence, it's actually pretty thin. The thinking is get that as a first response or a first aid technique to stop the bystander from doing something that actually is going to be harmful, but it is still recommended, so still do that. Good evidence for the funnel web spider, and good evidence for the snake bite. So the key ultimately with this, and I'm very much for the KISS principle, keep it simple, stupid, is ideally what you want is just the appropriate amount of pressure throughout the entire limb with that compression. And they have done studies, and they have found that there is an ideal pressure. So for a bite on the limb, on the upper limb, you want a minimum of 40 millimeters of mercury, and you don't want to exceed 70 millimeters of mercury. If you start exceeding that 70 millimeters of mercury, the bandage is on way too tight, and that's when we fall into some potential complications, particularly if this bandage is on 4 or 5 hours, things like compartment syndrome and things of that nature. For a bite on the leg, we want to be chasing about 55 millimeters of mercury, so slightly higher, bigger vessel, bigger limb, and again, not exceeding that 70 millimeters of mercury. And the idea is to go distal to proximal, only for one main region, so reason. So the Australian Resuscitation Council say that there's no evidence to suggest that going down the limb or up the limb is any better in terms of achieving that compression. But obviously, we've got valves in our lymphatic system that help to kind of push the lymph along. And if we were to go against that, so go from proximal to distal, well, then we're working against those valves, and we're potentially going to increase swelling. So some of the bites, particularly from things like our mulga or our King Brown, they inherently can cause swelling at the bite site, and the bandage itself can cause swelling. So if we're working against that, we potentially can make those kind of complications worse, and that's why they recommend the tip to pit or the distal to proximal fashion, I guess.
Question I've always had on that actually, because as you say, the way the lymph system is structured, the way the valves go, compressing up the arm is going to push lymph up.
Yeah.
What's the go there?
So people always think as well, it's like they have this toothpaste, I think, analogy that
Yep.
we're pushing, venom towards the heart and that. If you're doing the bandage correctly, you've got to remember that the bandage should be going like half a wrap each time. So it's not these really tight concentric kind of wraps where we are really squeezing each of that. We're essentially trying to get ahead of the venom, depending on where the bite is each time, compressing that lymphatic system ab above where the venom ultimately will travel. So when it gets to that site, it's compressed. So if you're doing the wraps, about half the length of each preceding wrap, that should not be an issue for you. And that's where practice, is really important with this skill. And this is what I really try and advocate, particularly amongst my paramedic colleagues. This is a skill that we may learn at university. You may do an induction school in terms of, whatever organization you work for, but very rarely are you going to get that bandage out again. And if the first time you're putting it on is a real life scenario when everyone's adrenaline's up, I'm not so sure that you're potentially going to be getting that bandage at the right pressure or, at the right standard needed. So it's a perishable skill that I think it's a simple skill, but really, if we're not practicing enough, it has the potential to be put on poorly.
And how then, as well, going back to the pressure thing, because I know they make the bandages nowadays which have the little squares in them for the pressure. But obviously,
Oh, the
as you
smart
mentioned, it's
ones.
different between, the smart ones. It's different between like arms and legs. Does that actually, like, how do you account for that, and how do you actually measure that pressure?
Yeah, exactly. And that is so I mean those bandages are good. You're right, you've got the square and the rectangle indicators, so you kind of know you're at that rough kind of pressure. But you're right, there's differences in, the diameter of limbs and things of that nature. So this is where I'm very much an advocate of actually not relying on those, but actually physically just practicing as many as you can so you get to know what that tension feels like. And this is where you're checking your capillary refill and those things are crucial, but actually knowing what an appropriate tension feels like on various patient cohorts and not just relying on this indicator. They're helpful for some, and I think from a first aid re response, yep, they're great in terms of taking a bit of that cognitive offload off people. But I think as paramedics, we really should just be practicing this skill more so we know what that's like and what that feels like. And we are taught, I'm not sure about other organisations around Australia, but I know here in WA we are taught in a replace technique. So if the bandage is on too tight, there is a technique we are taught where we can replace with another bandage. That comes with its risks, as you mentioned. In your experience at the hospital, when that bandage comes off, theoretically you can have a bolus of venom released into the system. So we would always say, if you come across a bandage from a first aider or a general public point of view, you come across a bandage that's on too tight, leave it on. It's still compressing the lymphatic system, but then pass that information on to the paramedic, nurse, doctor, whoever it is, to let them know, and then hopefully they're taught in that technique as well.
Evie, interestingly, I mean, there's a couple phases to a snake bite, right? There's getting bitten in the holy S moment. There's then the initial first aid response, or even the paramedic response, and then there's the hospital phase too. And it's interesting even hearing your story, because there would be some people listening who would probably be disbelieving that wouldn't happen in an ED. The irony is, I actually saw that happen in an ED, I think back in 2013 or 14, where after a storm, one of the volunteers had been cleaning debris, lifted a sheet of corrugated iron when he got hit by a snake. And so the members of the public actually applied the PIB. There was nothing really for the ambulance who responded to do. I was actually at the hospital when this crew arrived, and he was stable. He was well perfused. He was looking great. And because of the storm, the hospital was overwhelmed. The ED was overwhelmed. And so when this snake bite, patient got brought into trauma, there was obviously a real need to move them quickly. And it was actually one of the international doctors removed the bandage. And I remembered watching it from the other side of the hallway, thinking I must have missed something, because I thought that you would graduate that removal based on everything I have been taught. There's a graduated response to see if they become symptomatic. But within a couple minutes of this bandage being removed, the patient had a full tonic-clonic seizure and went into arrest. Unfortunately, it was in a trauma bay and they could respond appropriately, but it it blew my mind because these are, professional clinicians working in Australia who are still making these mistakes. What is, I know I've got my understanding of what happens in an ED, but what is actually the procedure when a snake bite with a PIB in situ gets brought into trauma? What's the next phase?
Yeah, so I mean, I think everywhere has their own like specific guidelines, particularly obviously different snakes, different areas. But basically, I think when I was, more junior and learning, how to manage snake bites in an ED, I was also a little bit surprised at how like simple it is. Like, there's not actually much you do unless, obviously, people are symptomatic of, having anything that requires resus. But all the snake bites I've seen, luckily most of them been dry bites. You obviously go in, assess them in resus, assess them for symptoms, neurological, cardiovascular. Obviously, the bandage is still in place at this point. Take some bloods, have a look at your, coagulation profile and all of that. If that's all normal after the, the certain period of time since the bandage has been on, you remove the bandage. And
So
it's all a
is
little
there a
bit.
graduated response where you remove some of it and then see, or does the bandage come off?
Bandage just comes off, at least in the hospitals I've been in. I haven't seen anywhere that does like a graduated response.
And so at
Which.
any point, if they become symptomatic, does it go back on?
At that point, it's just sort of like resus, and I haven't seen, other than that one sort of cardiac arrest, I haven't seen anyone then become symptomatic after that because we got a lot of dry bites, luckily. But I think the thing that other people, like public, also don't understand is that when they come in with a snake bite, if it's been wrapped up, like they're there for like at least 12 hours. Like we just monitor them, we do bloods, even once the bandage has been off. So we get a lot of people who come in saying, "Oh, I'm not sure if I got bitten by a snake," and then they're automatically there. Like we don't let them go. Obviously, they
Yeah,
can
they're almost
find themselves
admitted.
out, but I think that also then puts people off, properly managing snake bites and having, a proper appreciation of snakes and the process and how often it's not bad, like how often it is a dry bite, but also that it can actually turn into something nastier if you don't manage it correctly.
So I think people's perceptions out there, even a lot of medicos who don't work in hospitals, is that you get bitten by a snake, you got antivenom like it's magic, and we're going to supply it. But I mean, that's not actually the case. I mean, a lot of these antivenom. I mean, it's like you said, Matt. Two people are potentially allergic to them, but they also have to be refrigerated in quite a small bracket. Is there quite a small window, Matt, that these things can be refrigerated at?
It is, but what's and it's only something that I just discovered recently, and it gave me a lot of confidence in the system. Is that so? CSL, who produce this antivenom for us, they'll send out the batch of antivenom to the various hospitals, but they keep a vial or two of that particular batch, and they will test that antivenom routinely. So we classify to rank our venomous snakes in Australia. We use something called the LD50, stands for lethal dose 50. Essentially, they look at the smallest amount of venom required to wipe out half a population of mice, and that's how they rank all of our venomous snakes around the world. They have an opposite of that called the ED50, efficacy dose, or the effective dose 50. How well does the antivenom save that population of mice? And so with that batch of antivenom, they will continually test that. And if it stops working, they can then, with that batch number, go to the hospitals and go, batch XYZ for this, tiger snake antivenom, whatever it is no longer working. It's time to take that off your shelves. And then when they can give them a new one. So there is some variance in how long the shelf life is, but they are continually testing that to make sure that it is effective while it's in the fridges at the hospital, which is pretty cool.
I never
Yeah, that's
considered
pretty
that the
cool.
antivenom has a half-life.
No.
It's just something I've never used.
No, sorry, that the it's well it's the,
Well,
yeah,
it's not even
it's
a
yeah,
half-life, you're
exactly.
right.
The half of the mice, really. Yeah. Wipe out half the population of the mice, but yeah.
It's
Going
interesting.
back to a question on, oh, sorry, Sonny. Different types of snakes, and this is sort of going from Australia overseas. Because I know obviously I think you mentioned all of our snakes
they all work sort of via the lymphatic system for our venomous
Yes.
snakes, but that's not the case for overseas snakes. So what do people do overseas for?
Yeah. It's so snake bite is a huge problem around the world. So the World Health Organization have called it a neglected tropical disease. And so if you look at a country like India, for example, they have about 58,000 deaths every year from snake bite alone.
Oh, shit.
Now that's what we know. So it's going to probably be higher than that because there's obviously, people aren't recording all these deaths. So it's a huge problem. And there's about 400,000 people associated with morbidity or disability. They might lose a limb, things of that nature. So it's a huge problem. So a lot of the bites overseas are from vipers. So they've got huge fangs. And as opposed to our lapids, which are fixed in front to the mouth, they're like a pocket knife and they come out almost like a hinge and then retract back into the mouth. And they penetrate deep into the tissue, so straight into the muscle, straight into blood vessels, things of that nature. The venom itself is also slightly different. So a lot of their snakes have a very cytotoxic venom. So it essentially will just destroy tissue and cells, and then so massive kind of injuries to limbs and amputations and debridements and things of that nature. So you might survive the bite, but you might lose a limb. And if you're in a rural community, you might be the sole provider for your family. That's a huge problem from a worldwide perspective. Unfortunately, the first aid management is pretty thin for these kind of bites, viper bites. There's discussions of tourniquets or things of that nature, but there's nothing that's really been proven to be super effective, short of getting anti-venom. The problem is a lot of these viper bites, you need potentially 40, 50 vials of anti-venom for it to be effective. And if you look at a country like Nigeria, it costs about $450 for one vial of anti-venom, whereas for us in Australia, it's free. So $450 for one vial of anti-venom in a rural community might as well be $1 billion, and you need many, many vials of anti-venom. So anti-venom is really the solution to that problem, but not always, and also unlikely to be available to lots of these communities. So it's an area where we need more research and better interventions, I guess, in that hospital out of hospital space, but limited.
Makes our snakes sound very placid in comparison.
And but honestly, not all jokes aside, if you speak to people that know a little bit about snakes here in Australia, they will say to you, I would prefer to be bitten by an inland taipan, the most venomous snake in the world, over, say, like a rattlesnake any day of the week. If I get bitten by an inland taipan, I'll get a vial of anti-venom. I'll probably survive the bite, provided I've done everything right. I might be, a bit average for a week or so, but I'm likely to survive. If I get bitten by a rattlesnake, for example, I might need 50 plus vials of anti-venom. I'm probably going to have some form of gnarly surgery on my arm. Hopefully, I keep my arm. Really nasty bites. So, despite how toxic our snakes are, you'd probably prefer a bite from one of them over a viper or something else overseas.
You're right, noted.
So, stay in Australia, basically, from the world
Yeah.
expedition kind of vibe. Yeah, just stay in Australia. You'll be safe anyway. You're telling me my cobra bite was worse than anything in Australia. That's all I heard. Great. Oh, look,
Okay.
Ben, again, I'm sorry. Well, I know I rattled you early with that. So, yeah. Hey, there's, I guess, the most common presentation of a snake bite is going to be on a limb because we're either walking or we're picking something up. And so most people are fairly across the first aid interventions required for a limb bite. Not all, but most. But something that challenged me many, many, many years ago with a film crew in Borneo was as a cameraman was actually walking through foliage holding the camera up, he actually got struck on the ribs. And I won't lie, this even stumped me with a decade of clinical experience because in every single scenario I had ever been trained in, we were patching up limbs. And this torso bite really threw me, a curveball. And no one had prepared me for that moment. But, for someone to be bitten somewhere else other than a limb, what would be best practice in terms of intervention if you've got everything available like a POB? Well, you're 100% right. So about 98% of bites occur on limbs. So, like I said, you're walking along, being bitten on the leg, lifted up, bit of tin, whatever, bitten on the hand. And then that 2% is that minority. So that's the head, neck, torso, abdo, wherever, non-limb bites.
It's interesting hearing about your cameraman story because historically it's people like myself getting snakes out of enclosures at head height, things of that nature, where you're more likely to, be engaged with bites there. The only advice that they have at the moment for that is just direct pressure. So getting whatever you've got available to you in your first aid kit and applying direct pressure to the bite site. Again, trying to simulate, I guess, that compression that we get with the bandage. But I think in these patients, that full body immobilization is even more important because we're not able to get that compression with the bandage, so we're relying on minimizing movement. That's one thing I didn't add that. So when you the lymphatic system, it's really influenced by two things: gravity and movement. So whenever you bandage a limb, you never want to raise the arm up or the leg up. That's going to increase the movement of the lymph and movement itself being surrounded by that skeletal muscle. So a bite from a non-limb, we just want direct pressure and full body immobilization and a trip to hospital if possible.
It's, I mean, we discussed on the ground, and in the end, we actually just used a big trauma dressing over the bite and circumferentially
Yeah,
wrapped him. But I mean, there was a
sure.
challenge then of how much pressure, too much pressure. He's got to still be able to have chest expansion to breathe it.
Yeah,
But
need a comp real messy, complicated job. Like it's no,
very complicated because we'd also walked about a K and a half through the jungle away from the vehicle. So now it's going to be a carry. But it was just, I love talking about those situations or those experiences where clinically I've been stumped
Oh,
because
yeah.
obviously there is either a gap in my education and training or there's just a gap in my ability. Either one can be fixed. And I'm sure there's others out there that benefit from that. What are come you work with snakes, you work in emergency, you would have obviously responded to incidents in both. Has there ever been something that's challenged you, stumped you, or directly involved you?
Involved with like envenomation and snake bites and things of that nature. Look, I'm not sure about being stumped. I had a probably a recent experience where I was working as what we call a community paramedic. So you are the sole paramedic in a large region. And the region is basically looked after by volunteers who work on the ambulance. But because you're covering large areas, you might be, an hour, 2 hours away from some of these jobs. And it was a night job and it was a query snake bite. It was pretty remarkable. The night before, I had done a presentation to this volunteer cohort on snake bite management and envenomation. And then the job came through. And I got the job and it was all very lots of queries. No one saw it. It was dark and queries and fang marks and stuff. And I was an hour away. And so really getting there, and to provide anything meaningful was limited. So it was all very much just on the phone. But hearing the volunteer cohort do exactly what we trained, looking out for symptoms, upgrading to a priority one to hospital if needed, they're done. So even though I wasn't directly involved with that patient, just being able to, I guess pass on some of that education and that knowledge and see it reflected in real practice was pretty cool to see.
It's quite rewarding. Are any snakes that you fear?
No snakes I fear. I'm kind of jealous of you in Queensland because you have the coastal taipan, which is as far as our snakes go, that's one snake I haven't handled. Would love to, but you need to know you need to know what you're doing when you're playing around with coastal taipans. So they're the third most venomous snake in the world. They're our longest venomous snake, incredibly intelligent as far as snakes go, and they often will strike very high, so kind of chest kind of height strikes. Very athletic snake, similar to the black mamba over in Africa. That kind of snake. So I don't fear them, but I would love to. Probably the opposite. I would love to get involved with a coastal taipan. There you go.
Evie, I feel like I've got too many snake experiences for someone who actually genuinely doesn't like snakes. But I mean, the coastal taipan, years ago, we actually responded to a campsite, had some backpackers at it. When we arrived, she was actually asymptomatic, and she'd actually walked 800 meters back up a trail that had led down to the beach. She'd said she'd been bitten on the leg by a snake. Now, interestingly, you just said that they're athletic and they bite high. Her bite was actually above the knee. It was probably the
That's high
highest
for a
bite I've
snake, yeah.
seen on a leg. It looked like it was about 2 centimeters wide. We sat her down. Like I said, she was asymptomatic, and we applied 2 PIVs and then got her on the stretcher. And I remember talking to my colleague about it and saying, "Well, I mean, if she's walked up that trail, 800 meters, and it's taken us about 8 minutes to get here, and she's still asymptomatic, she's probably just a very lucky lass." And we were about 1.5 hours from the regional hospital, so we commenced transportation, and I was actually driving, so I didn't actually see the deterioration. It wasn't until my colleague kind of stuck his head around a window and he said, "You got to upgrade." And I remember getting goosebumps because I remember thinking, "Well, she's fine when she went in." I mean, at that point, it's what you refer to as diesel treatment, right? The best thing she can have is someone plant the foot to the floor and get her to the hospital as quickly as possible. I remember when we arrived at the hospital and actually extricated her from the ambulance, this fit, healthy young backpacker who, was well tanned, and she just looked like a ghost. She was respiratory depressed. She was obviously poorly perfused. She was ALOC, and it floored me, this change in her, because I don't think up until that time I had seen a properly envenomated patient, and not one that also took so long. I think I had my own bias from, again, the training I had received, that if someone's been bitten, they're going to be symptomatic within a few minutes, especially if they've walked 800 meters up a path. But this wasn't until 15, 20 minutes after the bite and after her walk, and after the PIVs were actually provided, that she actually was symptomatic to the point of rapid deterioration. And she spent, I think, 8 or 9 days in ICU. She sent us a big thank you when she finally got out. I don't like to think of what her international medical bill would have been for the insurance company for a week in ICU. But funnily enough, 2 days later, driving the same ambulance down the road by myself, I felt something tickle my ankle. And I was wearing a jumpsuit at the time because we used to wear jumpsuits back then. And there was, I can only describe it as a cross between a coastal taipan, a king cobra, a brown snake, and a dragon, because it was the most frightening thing I've ever seen in my life under the pedals. And so I made a very clinical decision to just stomp as hard as I could quickly. But because I was wearing boots, it meant that I was stomping the accelerator and the brake at the same time. So this ambulance was lurching from 80 kilometers an hour down to about 5, just rabbit hopping down the road as I swung into the shoulder. And it went up my pant leg. So once I exited the ambulance, I had to rapidly extricate myself from the jumpsuit. And by the time I did, I was basically standing on the side of the road in boots and jocks, watching the ambulance slowly roll into some trees. And I didn't care. I'm like, you know what? I won this fight. But the worst thing was, there was a round of applause not long after, and there was actually some grey nomads just having a coffee nearby that had just seen the entire thing unfold. And it's funny how lacking credibility you have when you're standing there in jocks and boots watching your own ambulance roll away, and you're trying to explain to them it was a snake. No one saw
Yeah, that's right. No, it's made up snake, exactly.
it. Made up snake. But 2 days after this backpacker had been envenomated by a coastal taipan, I just wanted to be anywhere but that ambulance at the time. And for this thing to crawl up the trouser leg of my pants, it was just, it's not fair. Life's not fair.
No. Again, you've had lots of experiences, and it's quite remarkable, really.
I've had two.
Oh.
Two. But I still put it down to the cobra won the first bite. That coastal taipan didn't win that fight. I won. It got the ambulance, but I won.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's still out there somewhere
Yeah. Well, we had to get RACQ to actually winch it out of the tree. So
now.
yeah, I actually lost a lot of credibility that day. But Matt, this has been an amazing session, and I, wow, Evie, I don't even know where to start with this.
I love it. I'm gonna look up some more stuff about snakes.
Did you say,
Please do.
I just want to recap. So 214 snakes, but 144 of them are venomous.
Yes,
How
but
many of those?
not all medically significant. Remember
Right, but that
that.
was my question. How many are medically significant?
Oh, that's a harder question to define.
I'll run with 144. Great.
Well, I mean, look, if you look at somewhere like WA, for example, we've got it would be a handful, really. You've got your tiger, a couple of species of brown, really, that we worry about, a king brown, which is not a brown snake. We can book note that at some point. That king brown is not a brown snake for the listeners out there. It's a black snake. Confusing. You got your death adders, things of that nature. But yeah, there aren't many really that I would say. If you look at the antivenom we've got it for all five of our major species, really those five species that we are worried about.
The poor horses is all I can say.
Apparently, these horses are very well looked after. It's a very secure, I think, from a biosecurity point of view. It's over in Victoria. It's very hard to find the location, but I'm led to believe these horses are very well looked after for the horse lovers out there. I actually had a
My
question.
sister's a vet, and she can confirm that
Evie, I
they
cut
have
you
a
off.
good
Say that again.
life.
Sorry. They are looked after. Good.
Yep. I was asking her about snakes and horses, and she was like, "Yeah, no, they're fine with it. It's good."
Evie, I totally
Yeah.
cut you off. You're gonna have to say that again.
Oh, the which part?
The one about your sister, because they won't be able to
Oh.
edit it. I totally cut you off. Sorry. So go,
Oh,
time in.
rude. Okay. Yeah, my sister is a vet, and I was asking her some questions about snakes and horses and anti-venom, and yeah, she can confirm it's horses are fine with all of it. And they live a great life. So
The most advancements in
yeah.
medicine, unfortunately, come from animals. But hey,
Yeah.
I'm also curious, where are the largest venom banks?
As in, where do they do the milking and stuff, or the?
Well, I've got a colleague over in Florida who is a part of an institute called Venom One, and it's one of the largest anti-venom banks
Oh,
in the
Medic
Northern
One,
Hemisphere. Yeah.
or Venom One,
And
yeah.
I was just curious if we had anything that relates to that in Australia, given that we've got so many snakes.
No, so our milking is done at the Australian Reptile Park, where they do the milking, and then they send that to CSL, who then inject all the horses and whatnot. Or sorry, to the vets, and then off to CSL for the horses. The Reptile Park have their own, because they have a few. They've got like king cobras and some rattlesnake stuff, so they have their own anti-venom for that. But obviously, given Australia and our really strict kind of quarantine laws and stuff like that, we don't have the same problem that America have in terms of a lot of exotic species. I'm very envious of that. Yeah, that company in Florida, in Miami, I think it is, where they literally have, because people decide they want to keep a pet black mamba, as you do, and they need to provide anti-venom for all sorts of snakes. So we don't have something like that. We are focused on Australia's snakes.
Evie, you looked really like you were in disagreement with having a pet mamba. If I ever get wealthy enough, if I win Powerball, I'm going to have a standing tall fish tank full of box jellyfish.
Oh, it's
I just
cute.
think that would be the coolest pet to have.
Sonny, do you know the animal they use to produce antivenom with the box jellyfish by any chance?
I do not.
The sheep. So talk to me about that interaction and how they came to work out the box jellyfish and the sheep.
What?
Yeah, nice. Water going sheep.
This is like when you talk about human hearts and pig hearts. I'm like, whoever made that
Yeah,
connection?
that's right.
Oh my. Matt, this has been an amazing session and I appreciate you. We always put people on the spot at the end. If you had one piece of parting advice for the listeners out there, whether they be new to their career or experience, what would your one piece of career advice be?
I would look, I have kind of always grown up with the whole luck is when preparation meets opportunity. But the more that my career kind of moves forward, I'm very much that you can create your own luck in this kind of industry. So put yourself out there. If there's something you're passionate about, network, speak to people, take every opportunity. And it's a very much a snowball kind of effect and a snowball industry, I think, paramedicine. So the more you put yourself out there, give yourself every opportunity, take chances. You might find yourself, fulfilling your passion, whatever that looks like in paramedicine.
Appreciate you folks. That's Pod X Medicine, the official podcast of the Academy Extreme Diet Medicine. If you want to reach out to Matt, send us an email, HQ at Academy X Medicine. If you like what you hear, you can subscribe to the podcast. And if you have a guest or someone that you think should be on the show, please reach out and let us know. Evie, that was amazing.
Yeah, that was great. Thanks, Matt.
That's welcome. Thanks, guys. Really appreciate it.